Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm your host, Hugh LaFalle. On the show this week, I'll be talking with Lawrence Lessig, professor of law at Stanford University, and our topic is intellectual property. Lawrence, glad to have you on the show.
Glad to be here.
The topic's intellectual property. May be helpful if you begin by briefly explaining what you mean by intellectual property.
Well, actually, intellectual property is a word that's relatively recent in our legal jargon. It comes from the late 19th century. It refers to what the framers would have thought of as a set of monopoly rights, which the state creates to create an incentive for people to produce what they otherwise would not produce, and in two areas in particular. One is patents, and the other is copyrights. And in the context of both, the idea was that because ideas are so easy to steal, and copied or printed material be easy to reprint by a pirate, that the state needed to create a limited temporary monopoly right granted to the inventor or to the author, so that they could get a return from their investment in producing this particular work, and thereby create sufficient incentives for people to produce this type of work.
Could you explain the distinction between patents and copyrights, please?
Yeah, you get a copyright for any creative writing or any writing that's original that you put into some tangible form. So when you write an email or you write an article or you write a book, all three of those are creative works or original works, which by their very creation gets the protection of the copyright law. A patent is a much more powerful right, but also much more restrictive. A patent is a protection you get for a novel way of, or a novel invention that typically gets instantiated in some form of technology, but not necessarily. You only get a patent if you're the first person to file for this novel invention or this novel process. And you get a patent to control anybody's use of that particular idea or that particular invention. So the difference between a patent and a copyright is, if I happen to write the very same thing that you've copyrighted, but I've never seen what you've copyrighted, then I haven't committed a copyright violation. But if I happen to invent the very same thing that you've gotten a patent on, even though I don't know anything about your patent, you can still force me to stop producing or using that invention because it violates your patent.
Ah, okay. Yeah, the other thing, though, I think I heard you say is that copyrights, though you do or can file for a copyright, as you described, a copyright is more or less automatic, whereas
right.
A patent is not.
Right. Today, I mean, this is not the way things were originally, but today everybody automatically gets a copyright for their creative work, whether or not they register it with the government. You can register works with the government, but the only reason you do that is to make it easier to collect damages if somebody actually steals your work. So it's now become an automatic process. Originally, in the very first copyright statutes, you would have to register your work with the government and actually give the government some samples before your copyright would be valid against anybody else. But that's been changed in the 200 years that copyright's been around.
Okay, so the way in which you get it is certainly different, and the other thing you talked about is the status of the nature of the protection is very different. One of the things you talked about is the difference between serendipitous discovery. If I happen to write the same thing that you've written, right, then I'm not guilty of copyright violation, but if I happen to produce the same thing that you produced on which you have a patent, I am. But I take it there's another difference, too, and that concerns the length of the protection that one
yeah.
has.
Well, this, too, is a difference that's relatively recent in origin. Originally, both patents and copyrights had about the same amount of protection. Copyrights initially got in 1790, Congress passed a copyright statute that gave copyright holders an initial term of 14 years. And if they survived that 14 years, then they could renew the copyright for another 14 years. Today, if you're an author, you get a copyright which is equal to the life of the author plus 70 years. So in the case of Irving Berlin, that would be a copyright of 140 years for some of his most important works. So the term of copyright has expanded dramatically, you know, maybe up to 10 times. And that's a little bit understating it, because, again, remember, now everything produced gets a copyright, whereas originally only those things that were registered got a copyright. So initially, a very small percentage of those books that were published under the 1790 statute were actually copyrighted. So the effective term, if you think about effective term as what's the likelihood that a work will be copyrighted and for how long, the effective term has increased quite dramatically in the past 200 years. Patents, however, have bopped around 14 to 20 years for their whole life. I mean, there's no now it's up to 20 years depending on how long it takes to process it and when you've filed it, and there are different kinds of technologies that are patented for a shorter period of time. But the general length has been pretty stable around 20 years, and that's an important difference between the two. In my view, you know, the copyright protections have gotten wildly out of proportion to what they originally were intended to be.
Okay. In fact, if we have time, I'd like to come back and maybe talk about that some more later. But let me ask, on the issue of the rationale, I mean, you sort of gave a hint of what you take the rationale to be in your first answer, that the rationale for having copyrights or having protections for intellectual property, whether they be copyrights or patents, is that it's a state's means of giving limiting monopoly rights in order to encourage creative production of one form or another. Is that the basic argument for intellectual property rights?
Well, in our tradition, the American tradition, it is. And this is a very important difference in the way that we think about intellectual property rights and we think about ordinary property rights. Intellectual property rights are government-granted monopolies that are justified only to the extent that they're actually inducing the creation of more productive works. The clause in the Constitution, which gives Congress the power to create patents and copyrights, is unique among the power-granting clauses in the Constitution because it's the only one which expressly says the purpose that Congress is supposed to have when Congress grants copyrights or patents. And that purpose is to promote the progress of science and useful arts, which science was thought of very broadly to mean what we would think of today as any creative work, so that's referring to the copyright power. And the useful arts was referring to the scope of what patents would promote. But the point is, the only justification for these government-backed monopolies is if they produce some public good in the form of progress for science and the useful arts. That's not the way we think about ordinary property. I mean, we don't protect your right to your car because it does the public some good. We protect your right to your car because we have some respect for the integrity of your individual right to control the car. But the tradition has been to think very differently about these government-backed monopolies that we call intellectual property.
That's very interesting, and if you would mind, I'd like to pursue it just a minute, because a lot of people, when they talk about property rights, are going to want to make a much more clear parallel between intellectual property and other forms of property. If I go get some wood and build a house, then the house is mine. And you're to respect it because it's mine. Whereas if I go get some ideas, so to speak, and make a creative invention, whether in words and get a copyright or some kind of technological device and get a patent, the temptation is to say, well, it's mine in the very same way that the house is mine. But you're saying that's just not true, at least not in the history of American law.
It's not true in the history of American law, and it's also just not true in common sense. You know, one reason why we've got to make it so that your control over your house is exclusive, meaning only you have right to control your house, is that if I come in and I try to take over your house or try to get access to your house or use your house, that is inconsistent with you using your house. I mean, the fact is, if you use your house, then it's hard for me to use your house, and if I use your house, it's hard for you to use your house. So there's some kind of what economists would call rivalry in the use of physical property. But intellectual property, there is no such rivalry, right? If I write a poem, I can say the poem to myself, I can give it to you, and you could say the poem to yourself, and it doesn't take it away from me. There's a wonderful passage from Thomas Jefferson's letters where he's describing the important difference in the nature between intellectual property rights. He says, if nature has made any one thing less susceptible than all others of exclusive property, it is the action of the thinking power called an idea, which an individual may exclusively possess as long as he keeps it to himself, but the moment it is divulged, it forces itself into the possession of everyone, and the receiver cannot dispossess himself of it. And then he says, he who receives an idea from me receives instruction himself without lessening mine, as he who lights his taper at mine receives light without darkening me. Now, Jefferson's talking about this fundamental difference in the nature of intellectual property, which is, if you use my intellectual property, I'm not harmed, but if you use my car, I am harmed. And that difference explains why we have much stronger protection for your right to use your car than we do grant protection for your rights to use or to keep control over certain ideas. It's not our tradition to allow either strong individuals or strong governments to control ideas and the propagation of ideas. And so we have a strong tradition of protecting what you could call an intellectual commons, which guarantees that after ideas or inventions have been produced, they become available for others to take and use as freely as they can.
Okay, so there's both less of a reason to give it special protection because my using an idea that you've had doesn't necessarily stop you from using it, but you're also saying something stronger than that, that if it's beneficial, then why shouldn't, at least in principle, why shouldn't other people be able to use it?
Right.
Okay.
Right. And part of that is because, you know, we all have strong intuitions about if I go out in the woods and I chop down some trees and then build a house, then it's my house. You know, I did it. But, you know, it's a little bit silly to think about the person who discovers a certain aspect of the genome saying, yeah, that's my discovery. I mean, yeah, it's that person's discovery on top of all the other discoveries that everybody has already made to bring us to the position where somebody is able to identify what a certain gene sequence does in the human genome. So to really figure out what part of that discovery is because of that person as opposed to because of everything else that went on before becomes quite arbitrary. And so for that reason, there's also less of a moral claim to giving somebody a strong intellectual property claim or property claim over the use of that kind of information.
Okay, because in some sense it's built upon the shoulders and the work of others.
Yeah.
Okay. And I take it it's built upon the shoulders and work of others in a way that building a house isn't.
Yes.
Okay. All right, what we're going to do in the second half of the show is we want to turn and try to talk about this issue in cyberspace because it's a very interesting issue there. But I'd like to pause for a moment for the benefit of anyone who's tuned in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Lawrence Lessig, professor of law at Stanford University, and we're discussing intellectual property. All right, you begin by saying the primary rationale for granting intellectual property rights, limited monopoly rights, I believe you called it earlier, is to encourage innovation. Could you give some examples of that, particularly within the realm of the internet, in cyber world?
Well, sure. I mean, let's take music. If somebody wants to be a musician and produce music, which for a living, the idea is that if they can't be assured of some strong return from what they produce, they won't have a very strong incentive to become musicians. So the idea of protecting people's right to recover, you know, a certain amount of money for what they've produced becomes very important, especially in cyberspace, where it's very easy to copy music or copy recordings and distribute them widely, very cheaply. So that's on the side of saying that it becomes important to guarantee some kind of protection for intellectual property here. On the other hand, so much of the internet has been built upon people having free access to really the commons of the internet, a lot of people fear that if the protection is too strong or too great, then what will happen is you'll have less opportunity for people to build on the works of others and less opportunity for that kind of creativity to mature into progress or innovation in the context of cyberspace. So cyberspace is teaching us something important about the value of an intellectual commons. And that what it's teaching us is not that intellectual property is useless, but that there's an important balance between intellectual property and the intellectual commons, which is necessary to assure that we maintain innovation and growth in cyberspace.
Okay, so the internet, for example, has flourished in part because there hasn't been the granting of strong intellectual property rights.
That's right.
All right, could you give some examples? I mean, I'm quite sure you have some, but one that most people who've been on the internet at all would know is that if you look at any web page, you can see the exact code that was used to produce that web page, which is a result of, if you will, the architecture of web browsers. I take it that that's at least one of the examples, by being able to see how people do and create web pages, by being able to copy the code, by being able to copy images. Lots of people are able to develop their own web pages much more easily than they would have been able to otherwise.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. One important feature of the way the World Wide Web was designed was that the code that would be necessary to build web pages on the net is always available for other people to look at, to copy, to take, and to do what they will with it. Now, in some sense, you could say this is just stealing. In a certain sense, it is, but it's the stealing, that this kind of stealing, which has resulted in the web being one of the fastest growing protocols for communication that we've ever seen. And so it's an example of how not protecting the protocol very strongly, or not protecting the language very strongly, is a way to facilitate its growth and expansion. And that growth and expansion is the much more important to the development of cyberspace than, you know, very strong protections initially would have been.
All right, let's talk about one more example, and we want to not get too technical here, but what's been called the open source movement in terms of code. Could you say a little bit about what the movement is and why you see it as important?
Right, well, the open source movement actually builds upon an earlier movement called the Free Software Movement, which was started by an MIT researcher named Richard Stallman. The Free Software Movement and Open Source Software Movement are both committed to the idea that the source code, which is what is used to write software that runs the World Wide Web or runs the Internet or runs your programs on your computer, that this source code should be available and open for others to read or take or copy or build however they wish. So that just like when you get a car, you're able to open the hood in the car and see how the car is built and take it apart and tinker with it and put in a different carburetor if you want, so too with the source code that fuels the World Wide Web or the Internet, that source code should be open in the same sense, that you can see what makes it tick, you can tinker with it, you can change it, you can incorporate it into whatever else you'd like to build. Now, that's a very different model from how most software out there is now being distributed. If you take, you know, WordPerfect or Microsoft Word, the source code that makes those programs run is not open source. You can't see the source code that makes Microsoft Word tick. And so many things can be hidden in the source code, and the source code operates in a way that only Microsoft really knows, so that Microsoft is in a position to control how it's used by others in whatever systems they'd like to build. Now, the open source movement is an important check on the power of individual corporations or governments, really, to exercise control through code. And in cyberspace, code is the analog to kind of the architecture of that world. Code, or software and hardware that builds cyberspace as it is, defines the experience or life that one has in cyberspace. And the importance of the open source movement is to make transparent the kinds of controls that exist in, over people in cyberspace so that they will have an ability to control or make decisions about how cyberspace should develop.
Could you, fairly quickly, could you think of an example, just to illustrate for the listener, the way in which software controls people's options?
Sure. Thinking about privacy, when the World Wide Web first was created, there was no simple way for web servers to identify or to track or to monitor users. Basically, people came to websites completely anonymously. And then with Netscape Server version 2, Enterprise Server 2, they released a technology called the cookie technology, which made it possible to track the states of users on the Internet so that if you went to a site, they would know that you'd been to the site before. Now, that's a very simple change in technology to facilitate this kind of tracking. But that change in technology makes it possible to monitor and track behavior on the World Wide Web in a way that was completely impossible under the original design. And to the extent that kind of control is secret or non-transparent, it creates lots of concerns about the way in which people are being controlled or regulated in cyberspace, contrary to how they might want to be regulated.
Okay. Maybe moving back more directly to the issue of intellectual property, I know one of the things that you're concerned about has been the use of patents. Let me back up. There have really been two things going on. On the one hand, what you've talked about is the way in which the Internet has been built in large part on intellectual commons, on sharing of ideas, on sharing of code. And yet there's been this new movement that's going on of giving people patents for all sorts of things that occur on the Internet. And that you have some worries about this. Could you give some examples of what you're talking about, the kinds of patents that are being given now?
Well, I mean, there are two forms of patents that create greatest concern for me. One is software patents, and the other is business method patents. Software patents, because the emergence of these ability to patent certain forms of software technologies increases the cost of developing technologies, software technologies, dramatically, because in order to develop and deploy these technologies, you have to spend all this money on lawyers who can basically try to figure out whether the technologies that you're using are inconsistent with existing patents as they exist out there. And that's an mind-bogglingly expensive process. You know, to do it properly requires an extraordinary amount of resources. And what that means is the only people who can produce software in that type of market are large companies that can afford large law firms. And so the one concern about that is just the way it will slow down innovation by raising the costs to innovators so dramatically. The business method patents just seem to me to be an expansion of patents way beyond what is necessary to produce any kind of incentive to produce. And remember, that was the ultimate justification for patents in the first place. Because you get, you know, for example, the Amazon one-click patent, which Mr. Bezos admitted in testimony, they would have developed the one-click technology whether there was patents or not for it, because it helped them sell more books. Well, you shouldn't be handing out government monopolies when they're not doing any good and when they're clearly doing some harm by making it costly for others who want to use the very same, seems to me relatively obvious, technology in the development of their own website. So here's an example of expansion of intellectual property rights without any good showing they're going to do any good and with a pretty clear sense or obvious ways in which they're going to do a lot of harm.
So your misgivings about both sorts of patents, both software patents and business methods patents, are that they actually are at odds with the original justification for copyrights and patents in the first place.
Right.
Okay. Exactly right. Well, now, Is there something special about cyberspace that makes this a more serious problem than it does with other kinds of patents and with other kind of copyrights?
Only because, with respect to patents, only because the opportunity for great competition, you know, because many people could be innovators and developers here, is sapped by this explosion of patents. So, you know, it changes cyberspace from this place where, you know, anybody could become the next king to a place where only the big guys, once again, can become you know, the next kings. And that's a problem. With respect to copyright, it's a concern because, you know, copyright originally is passed to regulate a very small selection of the public, namely publishers. And now it's basically regulating everybody who has a computer and connects it to the Internet. Now, that kind of expansive regulation of individuals in their ordinary way of doing business strikes me as unjustified. What's necessary is to at least have an evaluation of how to strike a balance between regulation and freedom here that preserves the original objective of guaranteeing this important space for the intellectual commons or freedom in development.
Okay, when you say there has been an explosion of patents, do you have any kind of figures to hand?
Yeah, I mean, there's a patent news service run by a guy named Greg Aronian. He calculates something like 90,000 software patents are now valid in the United States. Now, you know, just think about the scope of that. You want to write your own software project, 90,000 patents are out there. You know, you have to run just the cost of trying to figure out what's good and what's bad in your project, which is, you know, for many people to make it impossible to do business. And that's the kind of concern one has.
Maybe in the last minute and a half, you can sort of summarize the direction, at least, in which you think we ought to be dealing with and thinking about this issue.
Well, the clear thing from our founding about intellectual property was that the framers thought it should be a balanced right, that it should be strongly protected to create an incentive for people to produce, but it clearly was not the kind of perfect property right the way people protect cars or protect your house. And the concern is that we've lost that sense of balance. People don't recognize the importance of the public domain to the creative process and the importance of limiting intellectual property rights to some degree to preserve an opportunity for innovation. And so we need to relearn the importance of this balance and the tradition that we've had. And to resist, you know, very strong special interest groups like Hollywood, whose obvious number one goal is to maximize monopoly protections from the government through maximizing patent and particular copyright protections.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for appearing on the show today. It's been most interesting.
Thank you.
I've been speaking today with Lawrence Lessig, professor of law at Stanford University. This is Hugh Wilfollett, Friday's Issues. Good day.